Brexit means Brexit, a deceptively simple statement that obscured the most complex political divorce in modern European history. Ivan Rogers, Britain's former EU ambassador, pulls back the curtain on this extraordinary process, revealing uncomfortable truths that politicians on all sides have avoided. Brexit isn't merely leaving a club, it's a fundamental regime change with consequences that will echo for generations. The fantasy that Britain could somehow retain the benefits of EU membership while escaping its obligations was always destined to collide with reality. What makes this account so compelling is its brutal honesty, the stark admission that leaving the EU means accepting trade-offs that no politician dared acknowledge during the referendum campaign. As we'll see, Brexit isn't an event, but a process that will reshape Britain's place in the world for decades to come. Taking back control sounds straightforward until you confront an inconvenient truth. Other nations have sovereignty too. European countries pooled sovereignty because modest-sized states have limited global influence alone. When Britain demands the EU redesign its principles for our departure, we're asking them to surrender their sovereignty to accommodate ours, a fundamental contradiction. This paradox appears throughout Brexit proposals. The facilitated customs arrangement imagined enjoying customs union benefits while maintaining independent trade policy. With cross-border data flows, Brexit supporters dreamed of escaping GDPR until businesses explained the consequences of failing to achieve EU adequacy determination. Financial services face the same issue with equivalence decisions determining if third countries' rules match EU standards. These mechanisms represent the EU projecting power through pooled sovereignty. In taking back control, we've chosen notional autonomy over real influence in setting rules. Economic realities will force compliance with standards set without our input. What use is sovereignty if decisions affecting our national life are still made elsewhere? Brexit is a lengthy process, not a singular event. The EU excels at procedural negotiations, while Britain has shown naivety, resulting in repeated defeats at the negotiating table. Expecting quick disentanglement after 45 years of integration was unrealistic. Promises of rapid trade deals and claims that no deal would be harmless were illusory. Brussels skillfully exploited UK political divisions while maintaining EU27 unity. By April 2017, the EU's expertly crafted guidelines made the December 2017 agreement inevitable, determining the controversial elements of the Prime Minister's deal. Our "no deal is better than a bad deal" rhetoric fell flat in Brussels. Those who promised simplicity now push a betrayal narrative, ignoring their own responsibility. For future negotiations, we need less self-deception and better understanding of EU incentives. The withdrawal agreement demonstrates how the EU will continue using deadline pressures. In negotiations, sober assessment of others' interests ultimately matters more than passion. The referendum showed a majority voted to leave, but didn't reveal voters' diverse reasons. Some Brexit advocates wanted to exit EU political institutions while staying in the single market. Many non-metropolitan voters felt, "We only joined a common market, but it's turned into something very different without our consent." Both sides now claim to represent the true will of the people based on a binary vote that revealed preferences but not priorities, like asking Americans if they want lower taxes without specifying which taxes or what services they'd sacrifice. The Prime Minister's model prioritizes ending free movement while favoring frictionless goods trade over UK services interests, an arrangement benefiting the EU with their goods surplus versus our services surplus. We've sacrificed the services sector to end free movement, presenting the latter as a benefit while reducing the value of a UK passport. While border control was central to the referendum, it's misleading to present this as the only feasible Brexit or as economically rational. The services trade problem remains largely ignored, but will soon demand attention. Politicians fixate on goods and tariffs while overlooking services barriers, failing to grasp how modern economies bundle goods with services or the complexity of cross-border service liberalization. Services comprise over 3/4 of our economy, with the UK excelling globally in financial, business, legal, accountancy, consultancy, and education services. UK services exports to the EU were $90 billion annually at the referendum, equal to our next 8 export markets combined, making them vital to our economic future. The single market, despite imperfections, enables freer services trade between EU states than exists between US federal states. Outside it, cross-border services will diminish significantly. Firms will need physical establishment in export markets, triggering substantial relocations from the UK with major impacts on our trade balance and public finances. Consider a London-based financial services firm that currently passports services across the EU. Post-Brexit, they'll need substantial operations within the EU, moving jobs, tax revenue, and economic activity away from Britain. Multiplied across thousands of businesses, the economic impact becomes staggering. The Brexiteers who accused leaders of mis-selling the EU have now done their own mis-selling, inevitably disappointing communities promised a Brexit dividend. The proliferation of plus deals, Norway Plus, Canada Triple Plus, Super Canada, even No Deal Plus, reveals the dishonesty in Brexit proposals. These pluses acknowledge why existing templates don't work while pretending modifications make them perfect. It's like offering someone a bicycle plus when they need a car. Brexit secretaries falsely claim the EU offered the Canada Plus deal they want, when the EU's version differs completely from what Brexiteers envision. One side's Canada Plus includes services access and regulatory alignment, the other prioritizes sovereignty and divergence. No deal proponents are the same people who insisted continental manufacturing interests would prevail over Brussels, forcing a great free trade deal before exit. This didn't happen. Brussels showed more flexibility than key member states, and corporate Europe supported protecting the single market's integrity. The no deal fantasy assumes that by walking away and withholding payment, EU capitals would rush to create mini deals preserving trade. In reality, if the deal collapses, the EU won't offer friendly side arrangements, but will implement temporary measures protecting their interests while causing us asymmetric difficulties. Brexit has been poisoned by opacity and mendacity. While the Prime Minister demands honesty about problems like the backstop, extremists offer fantasies, no dealers, misrepresenting WTO rules as adequate safety nets, and people's voters ignoring the alienation a second referendum would cause. The government has fueled dishonesty, grudgingly acknowledging no trade deal would precede exit, using implementation period when nothing exists to implement, and proposing customs arrangements that attempt to retain customs union benefits without its obligations. Regardless of whether this deal passes or a new prime minister resets direction, the negotiating dynamics remain unchanged. We need leadership honest about fundamental trade-offs between sovereignty and market access, building consensus rather than eroding trust. Our future depends not on grand gestures or magical thinking, but on facing reality with clarity. Only then can we rebuild our relationship with Europe and heal our divisions. The first step is telling the truth about our position and the choices before us.